This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the topic of the overall economic recovery, it is possible to have a healthy debate. Are we growing fast enough? Can we really call it a recovery without stronger job growth? That kind of thing. On the question of the housing recovery, there is no debate, no ambiguity, no rebound. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 31st and final day of May. Remember how the housing market hit bottom? Yeah, never mind. Fresh numbers out today show that in the first part of this year, U.S. home prices fell to their lowest point since the recession began. And they fell despite the federal government's best efforts to juice the market. Or maybe because of them. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
The Case-Shiller Home Price Index is the benchmark among benchmark numbers in real estate. And today, it quantified that gut-dropping feeling many homeowners already have.
We have, in fact, confirmed that we're in a double dip in terms of home prices.
Maureen Maitland is vice president of indices at Standard & Poor's. Here's how that double dip played out.
Home prices fell between 2006 and 2009, and we thought they had hit a bottom in 2009. They bounced back temporarily. They have since fallen again, and they've now fallen at a level that's even lower than what happened in 2009.
And it's happening across the country. The biggest drop year over year was in Minneapolis, where Thomas Mussel is a professor of real estate at the University of St. Thomas. He says it's now clear the brief rise in home prices was a fleeting effect of government tax credits.
This created a somewhat abnormal market, and we're seeing the effects of the motivation or the incentives or subsidies for people to buy that normally wouldn't have bought in that period.
Mussel says the home buyer's credits did help sell a lot of homes that were clogging the market. But mortgage lenders remain cautious, and the market is still full of foreclosed homes that drag all prices down. Devonna Brazier and her husband would like to sell their home in Akron, Ohio, if they can figure out when to get off the ride.
There's no way we're going to even break even if we sold our house this year. But if we're afraid if it gets worse, we're going to lose even more.
The result is a kind of paralysis that affects the rest of the economy. The Braziers want to move from Ohio to Texas, where there are better job prospects, but not if they can't sell that house. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Looking across the pond, Germany is going cold turkey off nuclear energy. That is the word out of Berlin. Right now, nuclear power plants provide 22% of the country's electricity, same as us, by the way. But a decade from now, all that power will come from alternative sources. Today in Washington, Germany's ambassador explained a little bit why, and the world and the global energy industry were watching closely. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
German Ambassador Klaus Schereoth said, after Fukushima, nuclear energy simply looks too risky.
There are very complicated technologies which you cannot get under control 100%.
Germany helped develop nuclear power in the 1930s, and it had what he called a love affair with the atom until Chernobyl. Western Europe was downwind, and back then...
You couldn't drink milk for 4 weeks. You couldn't eat vegetables. You still can't eat certain types of berries now, 25 years later.
It's not a bad idea to ditch nuclear now, because it's about to get more expensive. Industry consultant Alan Madian says new safety rules will mean higher costs for industry.
The increase in nuclear costs will provide an umbrella for other technologies.
Germany wants wind, solar, and other renewables to make 80% of its electricity by 2050. But how do you store energy for days when it's not windy or not sunny? The technology isn't there yet. Michael Liebreich is with Bloomberg Clean Energy Finance. He says in the global clean tech race, Germany hopes its companies will solve these problems first.
The countries and the companies that are the first in this space are positioning themselves for the global development of these industries.
The trade-off is German citizens will pay a premium for clean energy. If Germany pulls it off with no blackouts, Liebreich figures other countries may follow. If it can't, those nuclear plants may run longer than we think. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This next story comes with a warning. What I am about to tell you could make your blood boil. Airline fees are up $22 billion in just the past year. Maybe that's because you can hardly look at an airplane these days without paying extra. And as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us, more fees are on the way, but you might actually like what you're paying for.
That $22 billion is 60% more than airlines collected in 2009. Jay Sorensen is president of IdeaWorks, the consulting firm behind the analysis.
I often get a lot of hate mail for this.
Before you flood his inbox, consider this.
If the airline industry was making buckets of money, I think that you could criticize the airline industry for being greedy. That's not the case.
Sorensen says jet fuel is going to cost U.S. airlines $15 billion more this year, and airline profits are relatively flat.
But you still hear people screaming at the airports.
Northeastern University finance professor Harlan Platt says that's because the fees are for things that used to be free, and they're often hidden in the fine print. But some airlines are trying to take out the sting by giving passengers a little perk with their punishment. When you check your bags with Delta, you get access to a service that lets you track your luggage along the way.
That's great for all parties concerned. The airline's getting some money and you have this extra information.
Alaska's offering passengers extra miles or ticket discounts if their bags take more than 20 minutes to get to the carousel. But however they're packaged, analysts say airline fees are here to stay. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Those housing figures we mentioned up top did not do anything to dampen Wall Street's return from the holiday weekend, but it was not a pretty month. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The NBA Finals hit the boards tonight in Miami, but the matchup looks a little different this year. No Lakers, no Celtics. It is the Miami Heat versus the Dallas Mavericks. LeBron James is, of course, with Miami now, so his presence on the court could make this series must-see TV. But commentator John Wertheim says there's something else helping ratings.
By most measures, this is a golden age in sports. Salaries and revenues and overall interest have never been higher. Consider that the NFL teams and players are risking a work stoppage as they haggle over how to divide $9 billion in annual revenue. Yet while you seldom hear it discussed, fewer fans are going to the games. Baseball's attendance is down this season. NFL attendance has fallen each season since 2007. Even if you believe the NBA's claims that crowds were up slightly this year, there's so many empty seats that 22 of the 30 teams claim to be losing money, combined $300 million this season. True, the recession was bad for business, but there's also this. It's getting harder to justify leaving that 60-inch high-def comfort of your living room. Go to a live event, and yeah, you get to be there, but you also pay handsomely for that privilege, easily $100 a ticket. At home, it's essentially free. At the stadium, you pay for parking, wait in line for concessions, and then for the restrooms. During breaks in the stadium, you get T-shirts shot out of air cannons. At home, you can spend breaks watching other games, even chatting with family. At the stadium, you watch games from one vantage point, yours. At home, you watch plays and replays from an array of angles. And as long as TVs are getting ever bigger and ever sharper, this doesn't figure to change. This trend isn't altogether bad. The NFL labor battles taught us anything, it's that there's significant value in the television revenue. But it prompts the question, in the future, who's going to go to the games we all love to watch? Corporate audiences, say the teams. And that's true, better to entertain clients from the ballpark than in your living room. But that's only a fraction of the seats. Even as sports grow, expect for the next generation of venues to be smaller and cozier. Expect to see more of the comforts of home, whether that's Wi-Fi access or softer seats. Best of all, expect to see a reduction in ticket prices. Otherwise, we'll have to change the lyrics. Take me into the ballgame.
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He's also co-author of Scorecasting, the hidden influence behind how sports are played and games are won. You can influence us anytime. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Today, President Obama tapped businessman John Bryson to head the Commerce Department. Bryson is the former CEO of the energy group Edison International and the founder of the National Resources Defense Council. The White House has been working to shake any hints of being anti-business, especially in light of new financial regulations that did not exactly please the private sector. In his new book, Age of Greed, Jeff Madrick writes about the various players responsible for untangling Washington from Wall Street. Four decades of deregulation that he argues led to the 2008 financial collapse. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
This book is very character-driven, from economists like Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan to Presidents Reagan and Carter. But I wondered if you could introduce us to someone we may not know as much about, though we certainly know his company, Walter Wriston, the former head of the future Citicorp. Tell us about him.
Walter Wriston was the pioneer in the aggressive assault on financial regulation in America. He wanted to make a bank into a growth company, and that meant cutting down restrictions on, for example, how much money he could pay savers in the form of interest to collect money from them.
And his philosophy, you write, was one of, you call it, intense laissez-faire.
Well, I think he was born to that. His dad was a very prominent anti-Roosevelt scholar who became the president of Wesleyan. And I think he inherited this anti-government attitude from his dad, and he put it to work in business.
How do you think that attitude came to dominate American politics in the last four decades?
I think the change occurred in the 1970s, around the time inflation soared and unemployment soared simultaneously. Americans were confused and then, I think, utterly panicked, as were their policymakers, and they were looking for scapegoats. Now, people were losing faith in government since the Vietnam War, but along came a number of effective politicians and a number of very effective economists who claimed it was the size of government that was causing all their problems.
Well, besides the phrase age of greed, which, of course, is the title of the book, you use another one, era of deceit. What types of things was Wall Street hiding from investors and from the public?
So much. The 1990s was one of the most deceitful decades of our history. You could not keep your job at a major Wall Street firm if you were a research analyst studying stocks, unless you lied about the value of many, if not most, of those stocks. The government knew about it. The SEC did nothing to stop it until it was too late. Citicorp, which became Citigroup, was the most heavily fined company in that era, the late 90s, early 2000s. Yet they led the way in abuses in the mortgage market in the 2000s. They claimed they had a debt-to-equity ratio of about 22 to 1. It turned out the real debt-to-equity ratio was 48 to 1. Now, there was deceit for you.
You know, some might hear this and think that you're anti-business. What you call greed might, to some, seem more like competition, which, of course, is what drives a capitalist economy. Is there a level of greed that you think is acceptable?
Oh, yeah, there's a level of self-interest, I think, is acceptable, surely. And occasionally you can't stop greed. But greed overwhelmed the system. The incentives were asymmetric. Finance dominated America, and it channeled money into paper shuffling, into fantasy. So, no, I'm by no means opposed to business, but I think it has to go hand in hand with adequate regulations.
Jeff Madrick's new book is called Age of Greed. You can read more on our Big Book blog at marketplace.org/thebigbook. Jeff Madrick, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Confused about whether online poker and other vices should be legal? Well, just give it the daughter test.
If my daughter grew up to be that kind of person, I'd actually be happy.
Free Economics is back, but first, let's do the numbers. Investors ignored those weak housing numbers and rallied behind a new bailout plan for Greece. The Dow surged 128 points, 1%, to close at 12,569. The Nasdaq climbed 38 points, 1.3%, to finish at 2835. And the S&P 500 gained 14 points, 1%, to end the day at 1345. For the month, though, the Dow still ended 1.9% below where it started. The Nasdaq shed 1.3% in May. And the S&P 500 gave back 1.4%. Apple jumped more than 3% after announcing that Steve Jobs will take leave from his medical leave long enough to appear at an annual developers conference. Intel shares chipped in a gain of 1.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. And by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners and new customers every day on the web at manta.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained agents committed to small business success on the web at farmers.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues construction spending data for April. How many consumers are enjoying that new car smell? Automakers are scheduled to release U.S. sales data for May. And a House Oversight and Government Reform Subcommittee holds a hearing on duplication, overlap, and inefficiencies in federal welfare programs. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The House returned to the debt ceiling debate today, with Republicans lining up to vote against their own bill to raise the debt limit. Meantime, Vice President Joe Biden continues meeting with top lawmakers on how to cut $1 trillion in spending. Some in Congress are targeting federal Pell Grants, financial aid for low-income college students that does not have to be repaid. Some of the program's critics are pointing to cases of fraud where students didn't use the money for education. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Pell Grants are a godsend for students like 21-year-old Nicole Harris. She can't imagine spending any of the $3,000 she got in Pell Grants this year on anything but her education.
I know. I would never do something like that.
Harris just finished her second year at Montgomery College. It's in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. Harris's mom is in the military and raised her daughter with a strict sense of right and wrong. So Harris was shocked when she heard other students talk about using their Pell money to play Santa.
In Christmas, you know, you got to shop. So if you don't have money for people, then it's kind of hard. So I guess they just feel like, oh, let me use Pell Grant money, which is not good.
The maximum Pell Grant is about $5,500. The government pays the money directly to the school. The school takes out tuition and fees. Then it gives anything left over to the student, usually a few weeks into the semester. Some students, like Harris, at more expensive schools, don't get anything back. Those who do are supposed to spend the money on books or living expenses. But there's no way to enforce that. Some students drop out after getting their checks. Teachers on some campuses say they know when the checks come in because it's a lot easier to find a parking space.
Teachers tell us that. I mean, I can go out and I can actually witness that when I arrive in the morning.
Lori Wolf is executive dean of student services for Des Moines Area Community College in Iowa. She says some students are just enrolling for a check. They drop out, enroll again the next semester, and apply for another grant.
They see that they get this lump sum amount of money, and it's like, ooh, you know, pennies from heaven, except it's dollars. Quite frankly, I think some of them look at it as, ooh, it's easier to do this than it is to find a job.
Pell Grant fraud is more of a problem at low-cost community and technical colleges. They're cheaper, so students get a refund check. In some cases, people shop around for the cheapest schools. Some of the best bargains are in Louisiana. Joe May is president of the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. At the technical colleges, only a fifth of the Pell Grant goes toward tuition. Students get the rest back, up to $4,300 per year. May says he has a solution. Raise tuition.
We have what is in effect the second lowest tuition at these colleges in the country, and we're proud of that on one hand. On the other hand, if our price is so low that people are abusing the system, we're very concerned about that.
But student advocates say higher tuition would price honest students out of school. Mark Kantrowitz is publisher of the website finaid.org. He says colleges should track the biggest abusers. Students who flunk out of one school repeatedly, lose their eligibility for Pell Grants at that school, then enroll in another school with a fresh grant. In financial aid circles, they're known as Pell Runners.
If you see a student transferring from one college to another within a small geographic area, that may be a sign that they're a Pell Runner.
The school could report that student to the Department of Education, which has already been cracking down on fraud. Kantrowitz tracks Pell Grant money and says most does go toward tuition and fees. Students don't submit receipts showing how they spend the money, so it's hard to say how much is lost to fraud. Still, Kantrowitz says most students are honest, and they need the Pell Grants to get an education. Back in Maryland, student Nicole Harris says she wouldn't be in college right now without the grant.
I would hate to have to not be able to afford school because somebody else is like, oh, let me use government money, basically, and go buy myself something. So
Harris is afraid the Pell Grant's critics will use fraud by a few as an excuse to cut the grants. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And this story was reported with the help of Liz Willen and Joanne Jacobs at the Hechinger Report. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It is that time every 2 weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It's about the hidden side of everything. But today we have a treat. The other Stephen, Stephen Levitt, Dubner's Dismal Scientist co-author. Hello.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So a few weeks ago, the U.S. government cracked down on internet poker. And from what I understand, you were steamed about this. Let me venture a guess that this left you perhaps with some extra free time.
No, not me, but my wife. My wife is kind of a semi-professional poker player. And so now, you know, now she wants me to entertain her all night instead of playing poker.
Well, so what do you think about this? I know that you don't necessarily think it should be shut down.
No, I think it makes no sense at all. Most things that are made illegal, everyone agrees on. Homicide, theft. There's a general agreement. And then there are these other set of activities which fall into a gray area, things like prostitution and gambling. And not everyone agrees. But I think poker is so obviously on one side of the gray area relative to legality that it just doesn't make any sense to make it illegal.
Well, and I hear that you have your own system of figuring out where your moral compass lies. Tell us about the daughter test.
Yeah, as an economist, I have a relatively underdeveloped moral compass, but the little one that I have is as follows. So if the prohibited activity is something that I actually think would be good for my daughter to be able to do, then I'm in favor of it being legal. But if the activity is something which I would feel terrible if my daughter did, then I would want it to be illegal. So, for instance, when I think about prostitution, what kind of my mind says, well, why shouldn't prostitution be legal? It's a transaction between two individuals. But I think, well, do I want my daughter to grow up to be a prostitute? And the answer is clearly no. But when it comes to something like poker, I say, well, how would I feel if my daughter grew up to be a professional poker player? Mm-hmm. And I think, well, that wouldn't be so bad. I mean, I'd rather have her be, you know, a great economist or a professional golfer. But if she had to be something, a professional poker player wouldn't be a bad thing for her to turn out to be. In that realm, I think, why in the world should we make an activity illegal when a father says, if my daughter grew up to be that kind of person, I'd actually be happy?
Well, by that logic, don't we have to outlaw high school boyfriends?
Well, look, high school boyfriends, if you could control everything about your kids, you would. But would I be in favor of outlawing premarital sex? I probably would. Now, that would be a hard law to enforce.
Indeed, right. Well, you know, what you say about the daughter test certainly makes sense. But I want to know what an economist thinks about the aspect of this where, you know, the cost of online poker in society, it really isn't imposed on others. I mean, I suppose you could make the argument that, you know, if there are addicts, the rest of us are going to pay for that some way or another. But does that make a difference?
Oh, it absolutely does. When we think about prohibiting activities, we do them either because they directly harm someone else, typically, and that's like homicide or theft, mm-hmm. or because indirectly there are spillovers that hurt other people. So we think that drug addiction, for instance, imposes costs on other people, or people have argued secondhand smoke imposes a cost on others. But if you think about poker, what economists would call the externality, that's the spillover onto other people who mm-hmm. aren't part of the transaction, it's just hard to see how that could be very large, especially when there are sanctioned kinds of gambling which people are allowed to do, like lotteries, which pay out much worse rates than do poker sites. And I think the easiest kind of message to draw from this is that the kinds of gambling which the government outlaws are those kinds of gambling which the government does not directly financially benefit from, and that the reason for the outlawing of certain kinds of gambling are financial rather than moral, and that's not usually the way we set up our criminal sanctions.
Stephen Levitt is our guest. Freakonomicsradio.com is the website. Thanks so much. It's been fun.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing retirement solutions that can help to guarantee income for life through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, practically since the first time one was held up to an ear, we've heard that cell phones might cause cancer. Well, with the caveat that still more research needs to be done, the World Health Organization today classified mobile phones as, quote, possibly carcinogenic and may increase the risk for certain kinds of tumors. The warning puts cell phones in the same category as lead and engine exhaust. Industry groups pointed out it's also the same category as coffee and pickled vegetables. Like we said, stay tuned, maybe via speakerphone. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that is where you can tune in for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up on this program, if you're wondering where Kai is, he is in China for the next 2 weeks. We'll talk to him later this week, but in the meantime, he sent us some tape. It is summertime in Shanghai. At least that's what the weather says. Hazy, polluted, hot, humid. But the government has not yet declared it thus.
The way the Chinese determine summer is the number of consecutive hot days in a row. And, I mean, that's actually a big deal because a lot of government agencies won't allow air conditioning to be turned on until stay. Oh, you get to that man. Fourth day, and then the fifth day, the temperature plummets, then you got to restart
that's
the clock.
Actually a great little story.
And you can follow that story and more at marketplace.org. Kai is blogging and posting photos from his trip, so check that out and join us back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.